paid into Medicare for decades. Don't spend retirement limping. The Joint Relief Institute treats joint pain fast. It's covered by Medicare. Call 708-888-0000.
Live from the biggest small town in America.
This is WGN Chicago, radio home of millions throughout mid-America.
Radio? Well, radio became the Pied Piper to a strange new world.
Time to climb up on our big shoulders and get inside our massive heart.
This is the Saturday Night Special with Amy Guth.
720 WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth. You heard the woman. How are you tonight? Glad to be with you. This, of course, is the Saturday Night Special, the show where we explore issues a little bit with a little more detail, a little more depth than we can during the week because time doesn't usually allow during the week. So we kind of sit back and we unpack these issues and talk about them and let them breathe a little bit. And we bring many different points of view into the conversation. And we always welcome thoughtful discussion about what matters right here in Chicago. And of course, we welcome your thoughts too. 312-981-7200. You can call us or text us at that line. If you call, you will chat with esteemed producer Griffin Filipich. He and I are at the wheel tonight with you until 9 o'clock. Happy to be here. Tonight, my friends, we are talking all about the history of protest and civic engagement here in Chicago. I bet you just went, whoa, that's a lot. It is a lot. There's a whole lot. And we're going to start with Haymarket because that was a very big event here in our city in 1886. We're going to start there, and we're going to talk all about it. We're going to talk about the 1930s and all the stuff that Jane Addams was doing. We're going to talk about a bunch of labor issues. We're going to talk about the 60s here because there were so many events that happened here in the 1960s. We're going to talk about so many different things, and we're going to talk about right now, because there are so many issues in our city that are weighing on our hearts and minds every single day and that we're talking about, that we're all trying to fix, we're all trying to think through. We're not always successful. Sometimes we have to kind of reach across the aisle and come together and figure things out. But we're going to be talking about all of those things. And, of course, the role that the city itself plays in all that. Chicago is a very unique city. And just recently, there was some data that suggests from the U.S. Census Bureau that suggests that Chicago is one of the most segregated cities in the country. So there's a lot to unpack here tonight. There's a lot to talk about, and we're going to get into that. And we've got two wonderful experts joining us. Max Grinnell and Lee Bay are going to be in here in just a bit, and we're going to talk about all of these things. So I hope you'll settle in, stick with us. Please reach out 312-981-7200 if you have a comment or a question or something you'd like to float our way. We always like to hear from you. And of course, I always love to hear from everybody on social media. I'm at Amy Guth, G-U-T-H, on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, all of that good stuff. And I like to have these conversations on the commercial breaks and all week long. So feel free to reach out there as well. All right. So we are going to kick things off here in just a moment with our experts. And we're going to start with a history of protest and civic engagement in Chicago. And we are going to walk through history of this fine city and talk about all the very determined and hardworking people who put so much sweat and tears and all of that stuff into making our city great, and all the people that are doing it right now to try to make our city even better. We'll be right back in just a bit to talk about all of these issues on 720 WGN.
This amazing city has such a history of struggle. It's the city of the Haymarket martyrs, the city of radical labor unions, the city of resistance to the police assassinations of Fred Hampton and Mark Clark. It's the city of Puerto Rican activism against colonialism. It's the city of immigrant rights activists. And of course, it is the city of the Chicago Teachers Union.
That, of course, was Angela Davis speaking here in our city just a few years ago, laying out a lot of what we're going to be talking tonight. talking about tonight anyway. She listed a whole slew of things that we're going to be talking about. The teachers union. And again, she started with Haymarket, and that is where we are going to start tonight. This is the Saturday Night Special, and all night tonight we are talking about the history of protest and civic engagement in Chicago, and why Chicago in particular, and the role that Chicago has played in these really important events that have played out on a national stage. I'm joined by two wonderful experts I'm so excited to have in studio. Max Grinnell, he's the urbanologist. You probably know him as the urbanologist because he's on Twitter as such, and he is an expert on urban design, planning, public art, the creative economy, and the history of cities. And you can find him all around University of Chicago because you've been there for a while, because you started there as a student and now you're teaching there.
Undergrad, grad, and now teaching.
You're all about that place. And of course, we have our friend Lee Bay here too, an African-American writer and architectural critic from Chicago. A Chicago native. That's excellent. You've got that on us because you're not from here, are you? You're from Seattle? Well,
yeah, that's
right?
True. You and I are both.
We got here as soon as we could. That's right.
Well, so did I. Just,
You just had a head start on us, right? But you also have a ton of wonderful credits to your name. And you began your career as a reporter for the City News Bureau of Chicago, moved to Daily Southtown, then to Chicago Sun-Times, and then where you became the architecture critic there and have written so many wonderful things. And then you were deputy chief of staff for planning and design for Richard M. Daley. Very, very cool. You've done lots of wonderful stuff, and we're thrilled to have you here.
Thank you.
All right, so let's dive right in because there's so, I feel like so much. We probably need 5 hours to talk about it all, really. But let's start with Haymarket, really, because what I think is so interesting about Haymarket in particular, in 1886, of course, that was one of the earliest big moments of civic engagement and unrest in Chicago. And what really strikes me about Haymarket is that so much of the narrative used then, if you look at old news clips and quotes and the things people were saying, they could almost be taken out of today's newspaper. There's so many of the same themes going, really, about police and community relations, and those same themes, which to me kind of points to a more systemic need for change, that it's really just not a current isolated thing happening, that we perhaps have had issues with CPD for a while, right? But, you know, Max, why don't you kind of start there and just riff a bit on Haymarket and your perspective on that?
You know, I think it's interesting today, the city, obviously in 1886, much smaller. You know, this is pre-annexation of the Village of Hyde Park.
And so we were just rebuilding from the fire. Really,
right.
Fairly
still
newly.
In this kind of first 15 years. You think of police, people, local elites, business elites, immigrants, physically, spatially, much more closely together. So there's also kind of, I think, provides those opportunities for kind of public space, like taking back that public space for protests, for kind of, you know, others call them riots, you know, kind of for that kind of engagement, which I think is harder to do for any number of reasons in 2016. You have that ability to kind of corral those resources. Of course, you didn't have social media to organize those things, but you certainly had that spatial proximity.
Right. Well, and I want to talk a lot about social media kind of in the second hour, because I think that's such an interesting thing. I think the first time we saw that really was like during Arab Spring.
Sure.
When I think we realized, oh, you know what? This isn't just like kids playing around the internet. This is actually a powerful political organizing tool. And I think we really saw that at that time. But you bring up an interesting point, and I really want to kind of hone in on that a bit, and that is that due to the way the city was at the time, it was not the segregated place that it is now. It was a very, very different place. And so it was, as you were saying, the concept of shared space was a much different thing in 1886 than it is now. You know, I immediately jumped to, I don't want to get too far ahead of us, but I think, you know, right away my mind goes to the 1960s when MLK specifically put protests into white neighborhoods to make a point. So because of the segregation in the city, because things going on the south side were not seen by people on the north side, and things were not being seen by powerful decision makers. And I think all along that kind of north-south tension in this city has been a very interesting one.
You know, it really has. But when you peel it back a little bit, you know, as you mentioned, the same things are at play. With Haymarket, you have people who are, you know, fighting for the right to work with dignity. And you have the money people who run the city who are treating it with some indifference. And then when it gets to a point where it reaches a flashpoint, the police come in. They're on the sides, not necessarily of the working people, and they're one of them. The cops are. Mm-hmm. They come in on this. They're sent on behalf of the rich folks who run this, the ugly, you know, the rich folks who run the city. And you have this kind of tension, which is which side are the police on? Who sends them, and who empowers them to go into these areas, and with what direction? They protect property, they protect all these things, and they do a good job. But I think you're right, what you said earlier, that there's something in the DNA of policing in this country that allows the sort of brutality that we saw in 1884, 86. We see it. I live in Pullman, historic Pullman, mm-hmm. and you've got the Pullman strike of just a few years later, right? Where there's a recession that happens in 83, 93 or something like that. George Pullman, the railroad car manufacturer who owns the town that the cars are made in, he shrinks the salaries, but he doesn't shrink the rent of the places that he owns in Pullman. So it touches off a strike. And, you know, before long, the National Guard is called in, and they're private strike breakers that are called in. I mean, the idea is to deal with this through violence, through head cracking. And that's the kind of thing that I think you see today that people are sort of speaking out against is that reaction is almost always overwhelmingly greater than the alleged crime that brought it. I mean, so that's kind of roughly speaking to me, that's kind of like the commonalities that you see between the two.
Well, I think that's a theme we see a lot. I mean, I think mm-hmm. I also think it's very interesting that as we look through major events that happened in Chicago, it seems like they're interesting boiling points in our city. You know, we saw it in 1969 when a lot of things happened really quickly. You know, we saw both, we saw racial tensions happening. We saw gender equality happening in the formation of the Chicago Women's Liberation Union. And we saw young Latinos pulling together mm-hmm. over housing and over, you know, it seems like, and it was all in a tiny pocket of time. But we saw this at that time, too. As you know, the Pullman was shortly after Haymarket. And then we have 1890-ish, 1889 or so, Jane Addams, sure. kind of, she gets in, she starts going, and she obviously played such a large role in this city and really put a lot of stakes in the ground for the conversation about women's issues in this country, which I think is also very interesting.
Yeah, and I mean, it's interesting. I'm thinking now of, you know, kind of these disruptions of capital, as Lee kind of points out mm-hmm. so eloquently, thinking about that is, you know, if we are looking at future protests in Chicago, you know, the ones in the fall we saw on the Mag Mile, but what's the most popular tourist attraction in the Midwest? Navy Pier. And to me, that I think it's kind of unusual that hasn't been a flashpoint yet, to be honest. There's lots of people that go there all the time. And, you know, that certainly gets a lot of attention. And you think about the kind of how do you corral that support? I think Michigan Avenue seems like the obvious one, but I wouldn't be surprised if we saw a Navy Pier in the future.
Mm-hmm. That would be interesting.
Maybe when it's not as cold.
Well, also that it's really cold out on that pier. But also, I mean, there's another one that I immediately think of space. Because that's effectively a tiny little peninsula, mm-hmm. you know, and by definition, right? And it seems like that the first thing I thought of as you're saying that is like, I think that it could get out of control quickly, if just because there's nowhere you can go at some point, you know what I mean? If like police start to push back on a group of protesters, you're either jumping in the lake or you're going to comply. You kind of don't have a choice. So I think in a way that's... I don't know, if I was going to plan a protest, I don't know that I would plan it on Navy Pier. I think I would want to leave myself an out. You know, it seems mm-hmm. like you could get your message shut down quicker. And that's really the thing. I mean, there's a strategy to it, really, that I think we think, especially now, and I want to talk about this a little more later, but I think we think of just a group of people just quickly jumping up out of their chairs and running into the street, when in fact, people are saying, what time of day should we do this? I mean, I think we saw that most perhaps effectively, but most clearly with one of the teacher strikes, maybe in the last 5 years, when several different groups decided to converge on Grant Park mm-hmm. from several different directions at rush hour. Mm-hmm. That was such a clear, you know, such a clear strategy of let's really get someone's attention. And I think that is where I think I get frustrated. Sometimes we see young people who want to be part of something, who feel who feel a sense of inequity and want to be involved. And yet when you really say, well, what are you out here for today? I'm doing some, you know, what's the goal of today's demonstration? What are you here to accomplish? Sometimes it's not always echoed back.
But, you know, but sometimes, though, you get the opposite, where people, where those young people are really articulate about exactly why they're there and what they're pushing for, and the sort of reasonable steps that should be taken next. I mean, they're not asking for everything to be taken down now. I mean, but they're asking for, you know, for the cops to get the boot off their neck and for them to be some reforms. You know, there's a faction that wants the mayor to resign, which won't happen. But all of this is part of a strategy, right? I mean, you know, you see it almost everywhere. There's a wing that pushes for the extreme, and there's a wing that pushes for what can be done now. And in between those two things, you get some progress.
Indeed. I think there's always, it seems like there's always kind of two groups, and there's you have to have some people on an extreme end just to get the middle to move a bit around an issue. But then it seems like there's some people that are involved in every movement that are more concerned, or not more concerned, but are careful anyway, to prize being effective over necessarily being right of the whole, you know, winning the battle instead of the war, of kind of like taking it battle by battle and realizing that progress is in fact steps, not necessarily, you're not going to go from A to Z overnight.
Right.
You're not going to say, okay, well, I solved world hunger and racial inequality and the gender pay gap. We're done here. You know, it's all little bitty incremental steps.
Yeah. And it's such a crowded policy world too.
It is.
I mean, and this is part of the message along with other practical concerns, because it's great with, especially with young people who have that energy, have that, those abilities and are able to harness and have the time. You think of people who might be raising kids or doing other things, it can be hard to kind of, how do you corral those people as well too? And are their interests shared as well?
Yeah, indeed. That's a great point. All right, my friends, we are talking with Max Grinnell and with Lee Bay. We're talking all about the history of protest and civic engagement in Chicago. There's a lot to get into on this big topic. And of course, we want to hear from you. 312-981-7200. You can text us at that number too if you're feeling shy about being on the air. When we come back, we're talking about the 1960s and beyond. So that's where we're going to kick things off right after this break on 720 WGN.
You haven't had other than only three or four instances of integration. You have saturation, which is a lot different than integration. And certainly there has to be some machinery set up in order that you don't go from just one type of citizen to another.
This is a terrible thing. I've been in many demonstrations all across the South. But I can say that I have never seen, even in Mississippi and Alabama, mobs as hostile and as hate-filled as I've seen in Chicago.
That, of course, Mayor Daley and MLK talking all about Chicago. Because tonight, my friends, we are talking about the history of protest and civic engagement here in our city. Because as we all know, Chicago has played a really key role to a lot of big movements for a lot of different people. And there's a lot to unpack with this topic that I cannot possibly all do myself. So I have my wonderful experts with me. I have Lee Bay, who is the architectural critic that you know and love. You know this guy. You know him. You follow him on Twitter, all that good stuff. And he is was selected as Deputy Chief of Staff for Planning and Design for Mayor Richard M. Daley. I've also got Max Grinnell, and you know him as the urbanologist on Twitter and everywhere else. You follow him too. He's an expert about all of these wonderful topics, and as well as a teacher at University of Chicago teaching. What are you teaching right now?
I'm going to turn your Urban Studies.
Urban Studies. That's all a good one. There's a lot to that one, too. How can you fit that all in one semester?
We barely do it in 10 weeks.
I bet you're like, a brutal teacher. I bet you like give them a ton of homework, don't you? Rude.
No comments.
Your students are shaking their fists at the radio right now. Well, I appreciate you both being with us tonight. And so we've been talking about, we kicked things off with Haymarket. We started talking there about how a lot of the narratives that we use when we're talking about Haymarket way back in 1886 are still ones that we're using right now when we're talking about labor, when we're talking about policing, community relations. Some of the things we read in papers that we see in archive papers from that time can be taken from today's headlines for sure. But I also want to talk about the 1960s, because that was another moment. You know, we saw like 1937, a lot of stuff happened, you know, kind of leading up to that. But then we saw a bit of a quiet period, at least in terms of very, very big things, until we got into the 60s. I mean, we saw a lot of different immigrant groups coming into the city. We saw some organizing and community organizing. But we really, really started to be seen in that national lens again in the 1960s when we started to see a lot of things happen, because we saw the Young Lords organization in 1969, a group of young Latinos organizing around housing conditions and educational opportunities and other issues. We saw the Chicago Women's Liberation Union, the CWLU, more colloquially known. That was in the late 60s. Of course, we saw MLK coming into Chicago. We saw lots of big demonstrations and lots of big issues coming. And of course, it was a big time in our country. But mm-hmm. But why did Chicago, in your opinion, play the role that it did at such a crucial time?
You know, I've always got this theory about Chicago, and it's in the city's DNA that at its from day one to now, it's a frontier town. It's where you can go to make money, and it's where you can go to squeeze the natural resources of the Midwest and turn into cash, and there's labor, and whether it's immigrants coming in a century and a half ago, or whether it's migrants from the South coming up in the early part of the 20th century, that it all those things causes a question to be called, which is, what kind of city do you want to live in? And so we go back. So with that, the cash, the labor, the cheap labor force, all these things coming together, you can run a brutal city in which all this stuff is put together and pushed to the advantage of the rich. And then it gets to a point where the people say that's enough, and they begin to push the other way. And it's the same question back and forth for the past 170 years to me.
Yeah, I think Lee really hit on something there too, and something that we're thinking about in 2016, which is, what is the city? What do we want it to be like in the future? Right? Mm-hmm. Conversations about social justice, transit justice, right? Mm-hmm. This whole package of things that young, recent college graduates come to Chicago, from all over the Midwest and all over the world. What about the Chicagoans who are here right now? How will they be well and better served through investing in our public institutions, mm-hmm. Chicago Public Schools, police reform, all of that kind of package of thing, I think, is part of this conversation then and now.
And of course, we have to mention under the banner of labor, we have to talk about the teachers union, because that's been such a big, big part of Chicago and such a big I know definitely that actions of the Chicago Teachers Union have rippled out through other school districts around the country, certainly, and a lot of other school districts have looked to us and looked at the actions that we're taking in this city for that, for sure. Lee, you mentioned the things that come up again and again, and the narratives we see over and over, and I think that's kind of been echoing through what we've been talking about so far tonight. And to me, that suggests a lack of progress, right? When we have the same thing, it's like a couple. If you fight about the same thing every single time you get in a fight, you probably need to get into marriage counseling at some point, mm-hmm. right? And so, but yet, for a moment in history to really end, to tie up, one party, if not both, has to be satisfied on some level that mm-hmm. some progress was made. So when we think about particularly the 1960s, because there was so much upheaval and so much, we also had, that was more of a televised moment, whereas before it was a much slower transmission mm-hmm. of information. Mm-hmm. So information was able, we were able to see exactly what people were talking about then as we were watching, civic engagement unfold. For better or worse, there were some that got quite violent in the 1960s, certainly, as had in other times. But if we're seeing the same narratives over and over again, that suggests we haven't seen progress when in fact I think we have.
Yeah, it's a funny thing, right? Things are never linear. Certainly the agitation of the 60s led to all kinds of things, in open housing markets, desegregated schools to the point that you could, given the numbers of the city racially. A lot of good things happened. It ultimately paved the way for the first female mayor, and then the first black woman mayor, and the first black mayor in the form of Harold Washington. And it set the stage that every mayor after Washington, Richard M. Daley, and to some extent the current mayor, has to borrow some part of that progressive playbook in order to govern the city the right way. So there is that. But at the same time, on this sort of other channel, it's the same back and forth. Well, how are we going to treat the less? How are we going to treat the less fortunate in the city? Not just the people who are homeless, but I mean, how do we treat the working class in the city? The things they write it over, as you just said, and Haymarket, the length of the workday, how am I protected when I go to work? All those things, they keep coming up. So while on one hand there is progress and there are breakthroughs, you know, there's still this rock in the shoe of Chicago and America,
right?
That we have to sort of solve.
It seems like the kind of the backbone of the issues don't get touched too much. We chip away at them, but they're still standing. Mm-hmm. They're still there, mm-hmm. kind of, you know, right in front of us for us to keep chipping away at.
Because I tell you, I mean, so I was born in the city, so I just turned 50 in October of last year. If you had told me when I was 14 that we'd be having these same problems with the police when I was 50. If they told 14-year-old Lee, you know, this is going to 36 years from now, this is going to be happening, I would say you're crazy. We're solving this. And I was 17. We got a black mayor, and you know, we got a black police chief. I mean, there's some equity in the city now. Finally, it'll only get better from here. And it shocks me to see as I get into my dotage that some of these issues are not solved at all.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's interesting. I'm thinking of when I came here for college in 1994, and I was volunteered as a judge of election for mm-hmm. in 95, and I met some longtime Hyde Parkers who had been involved with IVI IPO, who had been involved with the Harold Washington Party, and there are fragments of this, and mm-hmm. and coming from Seattle, which has, you know, one of the first big American cities to elect a female mayor, mm-hmm. And that kind of progressive tradition, and being the only way to put it is being struck in the face with a big D Democratic system was, you know, I had not experienced that before. Mm-hmm. And I also think there are moments too, and I know Lee knows him, you know, people like the late Len Dupre, who was a great leader for Hyde Park and a kind of a voice in the wilderness, who spoke out against what he thought Mayor Daley the Elder mm-hmm. Was not doing to address in Hyde Park and beyond mm-hmm. in terms of racial injustice and proceeding with urban renewal and so on.
I want to talk about specifically the Democratic National Convention, because that was another moment where there were a lot of eyes on Chicago and a lot of different groups of people had a stake in that moment in a big way. We're talking with Lee Bay and Max Grinnell all about the history of protest in Chicago. We'll be right back here in just a bit on 720 WGN.
Several hundred sympathetic delegates who walked 5 miles from Convention Hall to the Hilton Hotel in protest to the police who cleared the streets.
Right here in front of the H&M store, you can see everybody actually rushed toward that door. They were going to block it off like they blocked off the Apple store.
One policeman was struck with a shoe. Several of the injured were rescued by McCarthy workers and taken to a first aid room in the candidates' convention headquarters.
The angry protesters occupied the area and lay on the ground to imitate the way a victim was shot dead.
Because some people just get off the sidewalk, join the protest, and then two blocks down, they get out of the protest, and they go on about their business.
720 WGN. We were listening right then to some news clips from protests back in the day, protests now, and sometimes they're a bit indistinguishable because some of the same narratives are over and over again, repeated and repeated, because as we were talking about right before the break, sometimes the crux of the issue remains. We might chip away at it over time, but sometimes the crux of the issue remains. My friends, tonight on the Saturday Night Special, we are talking all about the history of protest in Chicago, and coming up in the next hour, we're going to be talking about the current status of protest and civic engagement in Chicago and the forms that it takes, because now we have social media and we have all these other tools that we did not have previously. So we're going to be talking about that. And of course, I have my wonderful experts here in studio with me, Lee Bay and Max Grinnell. You know these guys, you love them. Go to Twitter, follow them. They're full of wonderful information. And I'm so glad that you're both here this evening. So right before we left for a break, we were starting to talk a little bit anyway about the 1968 Democratic National Convention, because that was certainly a moment where mm-hmm. a lot of eyes were on Chicago. And interestingly, I think there was so many narratives running all at once, because so many different groups had a stake in what was happening and for different reasons that were so really interesting to me for that one.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, we were talking earlier about kind of that spatial element here. You have the movement through Grant Park, the movement to Lincoln Park, and the way that all the information was disseminated. Television, everyone's home immediately, right? And that kind of access and, the loss of control on the floor by Mayor Daley, just kind of, you know, out of touch with what was going on. I think that was powerful for a lot of people here and all over the world.
Definitely.
You know, it really is. And then if you think about it, you know, this is really a national issue that gets played out in Chicago, right? I mean, so in some respects, a protest was going to happen whether the convention was in Detroit or Pittsburgh or wherever it was going to be. But the thing that made it uniquely Chicago that brought it to a but the issues we just talked about before the break made this protest uniquely Chicago and made it flash to the point where you've got the police coming in and then if you've got you know this idea of law and order. And let me just back up one thing. I mean there's one thing that I just got to get off my chest as a native, which is that the one thing in this city that we struggle with as a people, as Chicagoans, is what democracy looks like. We think democracy looks like you go on election day, you vote, the precinct captain, the garbage can, and all that stuff. But democracy is messy. Democracy means protests. It means a guy who's mad and he's yelling at the other guy. It means all these things. It means opposition in City Hall. It means all those things. And we tend not to like that. When you look back at the Harold Washington years, the Council Wars years, and you look back and you watch the clips of it, you notice that both sides are smiling because this is what democracy looks like. The Washington forces, they like the give and take as much as the Eddie Burke forces did. This is what democracy looks like. We decided after Washington died that we didn't want that anymore. And we want a paterfamilias. We want a guy who can keep things together and keep things running in the city So to go back to your issue about your question about the DNA, what are the things we can't get rid of? That's the thing we're going to have to get rid of if the city is going to really be the world-class city that we want it to be. Democracy is messy. Bring it on.
Yep, seconded. That's kind of, I think, the thing that people crave. I mean, you see it all the mm-hmm. time, whether it is on social media. It's, you're on the street, and I talk to my students and other people. That's exactly what they're talking mm-hmm. about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think we do forget that. And I think we do think about civic engagement as ending after Election Day.
Exactly.
That we voted and we're done. Mm-hmm. But in fact, it is so important. And that's and we'll talk about this a little bit more in the second hour. But one thing that really concerns me right now is what I call slacktivism, you know, where you just put a little ribbon on your Twitter profile
sure.
or I posted a Facebook status, therefore I've spoken out. Well, you did, but that's not enough. You still legitimately mm-hmm. need to write your local lawmakers, and you do need to. And if there's an urgency to it, if lives are at stake, if it's public safety, there is a legitimate reason to go out and form together mm-hmm. and speak out against that, for sure. We saw that again in the early 2000s, in the aughts, when a lot of things were unfolding in the Gulf, a lot of military action. There was a lot of conversation happening about big oil. Mm-hmm. All of these things were happening, and kind of the first inklings of even what later became Occupy, and the Occupy mm-hmm. movement really started to happen at that time, because I think oil has been one of the many through lines. It's primarily economic, but that's been one through line for sure. But in that, in 2002, we saw a lot of activity around Chicago, all around military action in the Gulf and oil and control and power and the powers that be and all of those things. That to me was a very quickly populated event, and it quickly came up. I covered a lot of that, and I was out with a lot of the people protesting during that time. At some point, we need to start having our protests in warmer weather. We could time that better. I remember it being bitterly cold.
Right.
But it on some level, it just kind of started to go away. And I think that's something we see, too, where things just sort of start to fade. We see a really powerful uprising, maybe a second day, maybe a third. I mean, that's even playing out now as we're seeing some of the Black Lives Matter protests happening, especially over the holidays. It was a very powerful couple of days, and then it got smaller and smaller, to the point that it almost, once crowds get small, you find it both admirable that people are still sticking with it, but then also, what are you accomplishing with, you know, 12 people out there? And I think that to a larger extent, that's what we saw in the early 2000s as well with those.
You know, this is a good question, because, you know, when you look at a movement and the more successful ones, even whether it's what the Black Panthers did in Oakland in the 60s and 70s or whatever, usually there's more than one phase to it. There's the action phase that we see in the protest. But behind the scenes, there's an arm that is registering people to vote. It's feeding people. That's what it means. It's taking care of a corporal need that government or the entity that they're protesting isn't taking care of. And there has to be these fronts, because you're right. At some point, the protest fades or becomes just background noise. I mean, we just tend to get used to it. So you need these other elements. You need to feed people. You need to register people to vote to carry this fight on another ground and another venue.
That's so true. And I'm also thinking of another Chicago example is the work of Saul Alinsky and the Industrial Areas Foundation, Back of the Yards, Canaryville, and kind of this kind of consciousness raising, and that on the ground type, you're feeding people, you're getting them, you're raising their consciousness, and you're bringing them to a different place and saying, you are valuable, and this is how we're going to work together to ensure these kind of basic human civic dignities.
Definitely. And to me, that kind of steps off another conversation really about the multiple narratives around any event. You know, we there's a great TED talk by Chimamanda Adichie about the danger of the second story and why we need to be so aware of that second story. And that's coming to mind here because we have the one narrative, like who has written history, really. And we have that one narrative of this is what happened in all caps. But in fact, there are these other, as you point out, right? There are people months prior to anyone taking to a protest or a demonstration, months prior, there's organizing, there's conversations, there's community building, there's all these things happening around there. And sometimes those narratives are largely left out, which we're going to get to here in the second hour. We're talking with my good friends, Max Grinnell and Lee Bay, all about civic engagement and protest in Chicago, the history and the present. We'll get into all that here in just a bit. 720 WGN.
Live from the biggest small town in America.
This is WGN Chicago, radio home of millions throughout mid-America.
Radio, well, radio became the Pied Piper to a strange new world.
Time to climb up on our big shoulders and get inside our massive heart.
This is the Saturday Night Special with Amy Guth.
720 WGN, you heard the woman. It's Amy Guth. How are you? Thanks so much for sticking with us for this second hour. If you're just joining us, I am in studio tonight with Lee Bay and Max Grinnell, wonderful experts, and I'm so thrilled that you guys are here with us tonight. And we are talking all about, well, we've been talking about the history of protest in Chicago, and now we're moving into kind of the current state of protest in Chicago, because we all saw a lot of things unfold right around the Christmas holidays. We saw a lot of things on Michigan Avenue, and there was a lot of interesting narratives around that. The one that really, really pained me the most to hear was all about, well, first of all, people totally missing the point of why the protest was happening and people crying about not being able to buy shoes on Christmas Eve because there was civic engagement in progress. And I know people have strong opinions about that. Mm-hmm. So, again, we welcome thoughtful commentary, 312-981-7200. And, of course, you can text us there or you can find me on Twitter and we can talk about it tonight or all week long. But the thing that really, really got me, really, like, got my ears up was people describing, even currently, even in the last week, I've heard someone do this, refer to the Christmas Eve riots. Mm. And I have to say, having covered as much of and being out on the streets in the early 2000s with people protesting the Gulf military action, I saw much more violent stuff happening. Mm-hmm. Neither event was a riot by any stretch. But I saw more violent stuff happening in the early 2000s in a diverse but primarily white crowd. Mm-hmm. And then this crowd, it was a very peaceful demonstration. And yet, immediately that was called a riot. And that really stuck with me because I just felt like that's so unfair. I mean, the implication, if you really extrapolate that out, way, way out, the implication is that one group had the right to do so and one group did not, is really what we're saying here. And I'm sure some people might take offense to what I'm saying and push back on that. But really, that's what we're saying.
Yeah. And I mean, also you think about it too, not to put such a fine point on it, saying young African-American people do not have this right. What are you doing? What are they doing on Michigan Avenue? Which I think is patently offensive and racist.
Certainly. And it was kind of from the onset, it was like this narrative that this, it was a very young crowd too. I saw a lot of very engaged young people over the Christmas holidays, but it was as if these young people who were standing up for a cause they believed in not only didn't have the right to do so, as you point out, Max, but as if, like, right away, they're just going to do bad. They're going to not be safe.
This is so good.
How about Lee all riled up?
I'm all riled up. I can't take it. but it's a perfect intersection of a lot of things. I mean, you know, you know, the idea of democracy, again, that democracy can be noisy. We don't want that in the city is the one thing. But this idea of place, and this is the fruits of our segregated past and present and sadly future, which is there's some parts of the city that belong to some people and some parts of the city that don't. If this protest were even at 12th in Michigan, it wouldn't have been seen the way it was seen seen here. So these are the things that, we kind of have to get. There was other sort of counter complaint that I heard, and I catch the Metro Electric. So some of the protesters came down on the electric with me and caught them on the way back, where people were telling them, they were saying, well, you know, you should be protesting your own communities, the violence that's happening there. You know, what are you protesting cop shootings for when, you know, when black people kill each other? You need to be protesting that. And the fact is that black people are. I mean, on the south side of Chicago, 79th Street, the main drag that goes from, you know, from Oak Lawn, almost Burbank, all the way to the lake, got shut down right in the middle of all this stuff with black people, black protesters protesting black crime. And so then there's this, but it feeds into this idea of what are you doing here? You can't do it here. You should do it here. Don't do this. Don't do that. And it just, it can be aggravating. No doubt.
In fact, there's an event tomorrow. There is a protest tomorrow. I think it starts at 1 o'clock at Chicago Police Headquarters, and it moves south and it ends at 45th or 47th.
There you go.
But that will be probably less, less discussed outside of the particular community it's affecting.
Exactly. Exactly.
Well, and I'm thinking what Lee said about Haymarket and the disruption of commerce. You're disrupting the city of Chicago's number one, you know, retail shopping avenue, which is, you know, here all the way up to Burberry and you name it. So this is probably, even those comments about like, oh, I can't get my Starbucks or I can't get my, you know, whatever. You know, you're really, it's a good place to organize those kind of things because you do get that visibility, I think.
Certainly, because I think we forget the whole purpose is not just to run out in the street and yell and scream. The purpose is to create change. And the same thing happened in 2002 or three. There was a large demonstration that walked around the loop and ended at the Boeing building.
Oh, yeah.
That was huge. And there was tons of people surrounding that building. And it was, it's just not, it was just not discussed in the same way. And I think we lose sight of the fact that to commit the act of civic engagement is to want some kind of change. You don't just go out there because you're mad. You're probably clear on what it is you want. And I think in the case of all the protests going on over Christmas Eve and Christmas Day and a few days beyond, I think the objectives were very clear and very clearly stated. The interesting layer that I think that happened there was that we got to see, and I think this applies to, you know, everywhere, not just here, but we got to see protests play out in a whole new way because of social media, which I think is fascinating.
It is.
You know, as we kind of referenced in the first hour, we first saw that with Arab Spring. We saw suddenly something that was all emojis and fun suddenly was a very powerful political organizing tool and in fact had the ability to really change the narrative and change action. I mean, we just saw that this week around the Oscars, right? The Oscars were announced and the hashtag Oscars So White jumped up and the Academy has now said, well, okay, all right, you got us. Fair enough. We're going to make some, I mean, it remains to be seen if they make the changes, but they've at least said that they would because they realized there was a massive, I looked up the numbers early and I've already forgotten them, but there was a massive amount of activity around that hashtag and so many people saying, I want no part of this or this doesn't represent me or, you know, this can't possibly be real if that's who the Oscar, the Academy is made up of, you know, this demographic only, right? Truly. I know. We're all riled up now.
Yeah, no, we're all mad. Up. We're getting into all the media.
Well, yeah. I think one thing that was very, very much on my radar was during NATO was the role of social media there, which was very, very interesting. I was sitting at the breaking news desk of the Tribune and I had TweetDeck open and I had a lot of different columns because I was looking at Occupy Portland, who was here, Occupy Chicago, this person, that like all these different groups. And that was in and of itself just kind of cool because I was watching a Twitter search of so many different groups who generally had different purposes, who had kind of all come together and under the Venn diagram of we need to be here speaking at NATO. And a lot of groups came together and it was interesting to watch them all. The new piece of it was, to me anyway, in our city, was smartphones being able to stream video. Right? So suddenly we saw, and there was one moment even where a reporter called and said, I've lost the group I'm supposed to be tracking. There's just people everywhere. It's chaos. And his editor was like, And he was kind of, find them. And I realized who he was talking about and looked at their hashtag and looked, and I saw someone streaming. And I looked at the stream, and I saw a couple of streams there and opened them, and I could see street signs. And I said, Tell them they're at the corner of State and Lake. That's where they are. They're streaming live. And I think half the editors turned and looked at me like, wait, what? How do you know that? Why do you know that? I was like, behold, the tweet deck. This is what we're doing. Mm. It was also, to me, a time where we were confronted with a lot of misinformation, which, not to get super nerdy, but that's kind of speaks to, like, I think the French Revolution was probably the first time where we saw rumor creating political action, really, right? Mm-hmm. And the act of gossip was a political tool. And to me, that's what social media is. I mean, on some level, it's a new level of that, but it still affects change in much of the same way. Yet, it has the ability to spread misinformation, as did gossip and, you know, during the French Revolution, in such a way that I think we have a responsibility to it. I think about that a lot. Mm-hmm. Do we as journalists have a responsibility to correct misinformation when we see it? I think yes, and I think particularly when it impacts a big social issue, I think we do. Not to go seek it out, and, I mean, that'd be a full-time job. If you found every lie on Twitter, oh my God, that'd be a full-time job. But if you see it, you know, I'll tend to reply and go, real quick fact check, all good, but that happened in 2012, mm-hmm. not last year, you know. I'll usually kind of speak up on that. But it's fascinating in times of big actions, of civil demonstration, of civic engagement, of something like that, it is so fascinating. If you can't be there, to just open Twitter and look at that hashtag, just play. It's so interesting.
Yeah. It can be very fun. I think you think about how do you organize these conversations, and how might you even think of hashtags that can, you know, focus more on positive activities. I always see, and I know a lot of people like it for the same reason that, you know, if it bleeds, it leads, hashtag Chicago Scanner, mm-hmm. which aggregates all this stuff. You know, I think of it too as it's important to have this kind of on the ground information, but wouldn't it be great too if we had something that's celebrating small businesses in, you know, communities of color and mm-hmm. other things like that. And I'm sure they exist. So I would like to see more of that.
Well, and I think, I mean, and that speaks to why it's so powerful. When community action happens around a hashtag, that's when we all see it. Mm-hmm. If just three people use a hashtag, we're probably not going to see it unless it's someone you follow really closely. But it's when a lot of activity gets around a hashtag. That's really exciting. I mean, after the shooting at the church in South Carolina, there was a lot of stuff going on there, and there was a large public gathering, and there was a hashtag for that. And it was so interesting to watch that and look at the things people were streaming, and suddenly I wasn't there, but it was like I was, and I was able to experience that in a whole new way. So what we were saying earlier about how the 60s added the layer of televised civic action, now we have it's real time and it's right there in front of us, which is very cool.
It's fascinating, and it's imperfect, but it can also provide a truer counter narrative to what the establishment, for lack of a better word, wants to tell you. It wants to tell you a narrative of a thing, and it's through a spokesperson and through this, and then you can follow the hashtag and you can find someone who was right there. No, I was right there. I saw this. Didn't you see this? I was right there too. So it's all, you know, one of the things, and I'm not an expert on what happened here in the 60s, but there were kind of the seeds of this thing where there were newsletters and things that were published in Grant Park or somehow disseminated that kind of told people what was happening. And obviously it isn't as fast as the internet is because they have to print it up. But there was even some need then in protest to create an organ of some type that could tell the protesters exactly what was going on. Where are we going to meet tomorrow? Where are we going to be tonight? And, you know, the cops say we have to get out here at 11 o'clock. But we can still meet over here. They won't notice. All these things are still there. They're just sort of writ large and more accurately with the internet and with Twitter.
Yeah, mm-hmm. absolutely. We're talking all about the role of social media in protests, in civic engagement, in all the things that we do as citizens when things are needing change, when change needs to happen. So we're talking all about that. We're talking with Lee Bay and Max Grinnell. We'll be right back in just a bit, and we will continue this conversation because there's so much to get into when we start talking about social media and all the directions that civic engagement can take now. Right back in just a bit, 720 WGN. 60!
the next Martin Luther and just arrived early to the shootout. What if Hadia had an idea, but her dad in the park, she could have been Rosa. What if Eric Garner was just another warning? What if, I'm wondering, what if these what ifs are just waiting for us to wake up? Wake up, we gotta wake up.
720 WGN. It's a Saturday Night Special. I'm Amy Guth. Thanks for being with us tonight. We're talking all about protest and civic engagement in our fine city of Chicago because it's been going on for a long time. And you know what's interesting? Some of the same things we've been talking about way back then, we're still talking about now. In fact, if you go and look at some of the things people were saying to in newspapers and in writing and in personal letters about the Haymarket, right, about Haymarket and back in 1886. If you take a look at that, some of the same things are being said today, all about police and community relations, all about labor, all about these big issues that are still very much on our minds and a very, very big part of our city. I'm joined tonight by experts Max Grinnell and Lee Bay. You know these guys. You love them. You follow them on Twitter. It's all good. They're here in studio with us tonight, and we're talking about all this stuff. And there's so much of it. I wish we had hours more. Mm-hmm. I love talking with you guys about this. But right before the break, we were talking about the role of social media and how it has changed and added a much richer, deeper experience of protest, and how sometimes just the social media action alone can be a protest, as we saw just this week with the Oscars, or last week, or I don't know, time flies, recently, in recent days. But we were talking particularly about that the second narrative, the real narrative. Sometimes, as you said, Lee, there is the one that the spokespeople put out, mm-hmm, of this is officially what happened and what we want you to know. And for a long time, that has been what's written history, certainly. And adding, as we added televised, the ability to televise what we saw happening in the 60s, that certainly changed that. When we saw so much happening in this country in the 60s, we could see it. We could really see it, not mm-hmm just hear about it or read about it. And then now with social media, we see it in a whole new way. And what I think of right away is Ferguson, because here was a moment when there was media blackout. None of us could get down there. Nobody in our profession could get there to cover the event. And yet citizens pulled out smartphones and started streaming video. And there was one woman in particular that, she's become kind of this like internet famous person now because she was streaming video of here's exactly what I'm looking at. And again, as you say, Lee, it was an interesting way that we saw a different narrative and the real truth of what was happening versus everything's fine.
Exactly.
It's all good here. Everybody just chill. It's all good. So there's all these extra layers. And in many ways, social media and technology has really made the barrier of entry to doing the act of broadcasting and to sharing information, and to especially when that information is connected to public safety and lives are at stake. It's been very, very interesting to see the role that social media plays in that. We are going to get you to news here in a second, but when we come back, we are still talking about protest in Chicago, including protest and things happening right now in our city and why and who's involved and all those good things. We're talking with Lee Bay and Max Grinnell. We'll be back here in just a bit on 720 WGN.
Grown accustomed to the ones you can tell that have been practicing and they've come out, they get the crowd going and they make sure that the crowd stays together.
WGN. It's a Saturday night special. I'm Amy Guth. We're taking your calls and text messages 312-981-7200. And as you probably guessed by hearing that audio, we're talking all about the history of protest in Chicago and the current state of protest in Chicago. And before the break, we were talking about the role that social media plays. And sometimes we think of that in a pretty simple way, and just in terms of, well, now we can watch it on Twitter. Now we can do that. But right before the break, we were starting to step into a little bit bigger conversation. And by we, I mean my esteemed panel of guests tonight, Max Grinnell and Lee Bay, who are with me in studio. And we are talking about all these very important topics. And where we started to lead before the break was really that it's so much more than just an extra layer or a more multimedia experience of seeing protest. But in fact, In fact, it's more about the truth and the narrative and the things that we think we believe versus the things we know versus the things that emerge later, mm-hmm. and that kind of thing. And I can't help but think there would be many times in history that it would have been helpful. Imagine if we would have had social media through so many other different events throughout history that we've talked about tonight, and how differently that might have played out.
You know, indeed, you think about the shooting of Fred Hampton and Mark Clark, the two Black Panthers, by the state's attorney's police here in Chicago back in the late 60s. You know, there was a narrative that was put out by the powers that be, and it seemed plausible. These guys were Black Panthers. They were shooting at us. We shot back, and they got killed. And we find out weeks later, that wasn't the case at all, that the Black Panthers didn't shoot at all. If there was a social media outlet then, if there were Twitter then, there would have been a guy downstairs who said, look, you know, this is what happened, and we would have got to the truth a lot sooner.
He would have put a picture on Instagram.
Oh, exactly.
It would have been done.
The people in the shooting, in the apartment would have been able to show the world, mm-hmm. Ultimately. I mean, it happened slowly afterwards where TV cameras came through. But to have it instantaneously, to be able to shout down that false narrative the instant it's created would have been a powerful thing.
Which is a very powerful thing because when narratives emerge later, I think we've had time, and I say we, people who think one thing or another about a narrative, we've had kind of time to buttress information in our heads, mm-hmm. to confirm our own bias or challenge our own bias and we've kind of settled on a story, I think. And so I think there is a lot, I think it's important to get multiple stories out quickly. And I think it's important to always consider what is it I don't know about what's happening right now. And I think that's challenging. We all only can work from the framework that we have, right? But mm-hmm. but I think it's important to challenge ourselves to do that, especially if we're going to get anywhere, right? I think a theme that's come up a lot is that the more things change, the more they stay the same. And that some of the things we were talking about during Haymarket in 1886 we're still trying to figure them out now. And I think that's very true. There was a piece in Chicago Tribune just recently. You can see it at chicagotribune.com. And it was written by Darlene Glanton, a very, very wonderful writer. Big fan of hers, of course. And the headline is, "For Shame, Chicago, Why Have You Not Fulfilled King's Dream?" Hmm. And it poses some very interesting questions. And it's quite a bit of an admonishment, really. And there's one line in particular that sticks out so much. And she quotes MLK, and then she says, "King was talking about the Jim Crow South in 1963. But it sounds a lot like Chicago in 2016. And again, there's a moment where we're looking at systemic changes that need to happen, where we're looking at the same things repeating themselves over and over for different groups, for different people, in different ways, but again and again and again.
She makes a powerful point with that because, look, you know, if there were, let's say this was in Chicago, let's say it's a city in the South, some undetermined place, where most of the people who are shot by police are Black, most of the schools that are closed are Black schools, you know, and on and on and on, we'd say, President Johnson, go down there with the troops and mm-hmm. save these people down there. We don't see it that way because it's Chicago. We see the skyscrapers and the beauty and all that kind of thing. But, yeah, if I mean, she's absolutely right. If this were a small southern town with this stuff happening in it, the nation would be outraged, mm-hmm. and justifiably so.
And I think it's interesting to think about when Dr. King was here and the quest for open housing. You know, the legacy of restrictive racial covenants in the city of Chicago is still with us today. Mm-hmm. And of course, in 2016, you know, if you're an African-American family and you go to Lincoln Park, Lakeview, et cetera, height, you know, no one's going to say, no, you cannot live here. But there's all kinds of other subtle forms, racial steering, which is well documented among real estate agents. And of course, the shrinking of the middle class generally,
exactly.
African-American community, white community, Asian-American community. So kind of getting that mix, we are stuck with these palimpsests of the past. I mean, this is really what it's part of.
We really are. And think of the flip side. So that family that you talked about, they said, okay, mm-hmm. fine. You don't want me in Lincoln Park, I won't go. I'll stay in Auburn and Gresham and I'll have a bigger house. And that house will be worth less 60 years from now than that house in Lincoln Park is today.
Absolutely.
So there's a price for going to some place, and there's a price for staying still. I mean, it's like, how can you win?
Right.
In many respects.
And it's kind of a double, if not triple whammy, in terms of that investment equity
mm-hmm.
for the future.
Exactly.
Do you think that, because sometimes I wake up and I think, I think we're moving backwards. Mm-hmm. I think it's worse now than it ever, you know, I sometimes think, gosh, I don't remember things ever being this sexist. I don't, why is everything so racist right now? What's happening in the world? You think we're making progress and it's looking terrible. Is that the result of an election year? Because certainly those issues get played up. Is that an election year, or do you think that we are perhaps moving backwards?
Can I weigh in on this one, too?
Please do.
Do you mind?
Please
the voice
do.
Of God is
no, just an observation. Everyone was doing the post-racial society nonsense after 2008 in the election. Starting in 2008, that's when the bigots, the sexists, and the other asserted social nitwits suddenly decided it was okay to come out of the closet, and instead of just writing those things in emails and on Twitter, to say them out loud.
As a result of the, because of the current administration, you're saying?
I think as soon as we elected an African-American president, a switch snapped in the heads of some folks in our country. And they decided that, you know what? Such and such is in the White House. Well, hell, we can't have that. And they started to say the things that they have only been saying in those quiet rooms behind closed doors all these years. They decided it was perfectly fine to now say it out loud.
Well, that's, I mean, that could very well be that perhaps it's always been just as it is right now. We just didn't see it.
They just didn't say it out loud. It's the only thing that's really changed.
That could absolutely, I mean, I don't know. Who knows for sure? But I think that's certainly a valid point to consider. But it's concerning because I think two things are happening. We have, I think, pretty overt things happening. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a particular presidential candidate right now that we kind of all laughed off at first, but in fact is saying very inflammatory and xenophobic things. I think we can all agree on that. Whether you like the guy or not, I think we can all agree that it's quite xenophobic, the things that he's saying. So we have, on one hand, some shockingly overt racist and sexist things. But then I think we also have like a strange, subtle way that's maybe more dangerous. That's not really the word because it's not life and death per se, but it's subtle and a kind of a, I don't want to use the word systemic again, but it seems like just subtle things like gender pay gap. It's not open. Like it's the glass ceiling. It's not open. It's not really talked about except within the group of women who are being oppressed. Right. Mm-hmm. It's like a subtler, more, you know, it's kind of the example that you gave, Max, about a family going to Lakeview, right? If a black family goes to Lakeview, it may not be like an overt thing like it would have been decades ago, but there probably would be subtle things. Or as you said, like the real estate agent might be a little right? And like subtler things. And I feel like that's emerged and I feel like I see more of that. But to your point, David, I think that could be what kicked it all off.
You know, I think David makes a good point. And certainly it's one that I've heard talked about in many circles, that night in Grant Park and the things that happened there. You know, there's some people, black and white, who saw that as a breakthrough, a high point in the nation's history, and there's others who saw that and were terrified by it, and are speaking out. And I think what's happened is that politicians, being who they are, generally speaking, they put their wet finger to the wind, and they can figure out, I got 6 votes on that side, but 4 votes. On that, I'm going where the 6 votes are. So I think there's that, and I think that certain news media realize that you can. There's an audience there for that, and they push it. So I think he's right. I think that Obama's election created a moment that opened it was like this old "Was Not Was" song, "Out Come the Freaks," and I think they came out, and politicians figured out how to get them on their side.
Well, and
one station at least, one cable station at least has figured out a way to create an audience and monetize that.
Two things: one, that network station has created a monster they can no longer control. Mm-hmm. Number one, mm-hmm. and number two, additional proof that the freaks have come out. The gun sales have skyrocketed since 2008. What happened in 2008?
Since 2008.
Just mentioning it in passing, little detail.
Not 2001, we thought the terrorists were going to come get us all.
Oh, yeah. Nothing happened.
Not then, but in 2008. That's a good point.
We're unpacking a lot of big issues here tonight. We're talking with Max Grinnell and Lee Bay, and of course, our esteemed colleague, David Jennings, about all these very important issues. We've been talking about the history of protest and civic engagement in Chicago and the current state of it, not just in Chicago, but in our country, and how social media influences things, how major events influence group behavior, all of those very important things that we really need more than 2 hours to solve, but we're trying mighty hard. So on the other side of the break, we're going to talk about all of these things, and we're going to continue this conversation about all of these big issues and about social media and the role that it plays and what we're doing now and what we think is ahead here on 720 WGN. WGN. It's a Saturday night special. I'm Amy Guth. Thanks for being with us tonight. We've been talking about the history and current state of protest and civic engagement here in Chicago. And all tonight, I've been hanging out with my very good friends, Lee Bay and Max Grinnell. We have been talking about all these issues and getting ourselves so riled up because there are so many things to talk about. And indeed, there are. And, you know, there's one that we missed and one that has to do with this very station. And that is the Chicago musicians who it was very complicated, but it resulted. We hear about the Petrillo Bandshell, and we don't know who that is. But in fact, Petrillo had a very big hand in musicians recording music, getting royalties for them versus playing live, and how they were paid, and really changed a big piece of the music industry right here in Chicago. It was very cool. And we skipped right over that part because we got all riled up about the 60s. We skipped over the 40s, indeed. But that had a big place because so many musicians were playing live on the radio and then getting paid, but then their music being recorded, played on the radio, not getting paid. But again, there's a narrative that's still kind of going because now that we have Spotify and all those subscription streaming services, musicians are kind of going, well, wait a minute, I got like 100,000 listens and I only made like $40. Wait a minute, what's going on? Something's not adding up here. So again, we've kind of come to that conclusion a lot too, things that we think are solved, not so solved. They in fact keep coming up again and again and again, right? So as we are wrapping up, you know, we started this time together. We played a little bit of audio talking about, it was a bit of MLK talking about some not goodness that he had encountered in Chicago when he came here to do some good. And as we just passed the MLK holiday, I think it's interesting to think about as we think about the current state of things and how things go and all of that. It's interesting. You can't help but think, if he were alive today, what would he think? What would he think about the world that we have? I mean, earlier in the program, Lee, you said if we would have told 14-year-old you that we would still be talking about some of these issues that we were talking about when you were 14, you would have never believed it. But again, you know, so I can't help but think he might be kind of not happy with us you were around today.
This is interesting. It could be a very mixed bag. I think perhaps maybe a little bit unhappy because that's what, you know, that's what revolutionaries, you know, that's what they are. But I think that if he lived and he could have seen a black mayor, the explosion of the black middle class, you know, if you want to see what the city looked like in 1968, watch Medium Cool or some movie from 1968 and see how people were living. And it's shocking. It's an insult to third world. It's an insult to say third world. It's so badly. And to see that even in some of the poorest neighborhoods, the living conditions, the streets, the garbage, all that kind of stuff is lifted up. I think some of these things, you know, could be victories in the fact that people are living in big houses on the south side, southern suburbs, that you can do these things. But I think the police brutality issue, the economic violence issues, I think the school issues, I think would vex him to this day.
Yeah, I think, Medium Cool was a great visual representation. Yeah. That's a great suggestion. I'm reminded I need to rewatch it, Lee.
Right.
And I think, you know, in terms of specific policy recommendations, you know, one of the things he was working on before he was assassinated was, you know, addressing, you know, class and income inequality. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, you'd be thinking, could Chicago have a living wage? along with some of the other things we've mentioned. You know, is that something that passed? And it's certainly been something that's passed in a number of cities since the early 90s, gaining traction in Baltimore and moving to other places. So, you know, maybe something like that. It's certainly gotten traction in Seattle. It's a pitch from my own hometown.
Right.
Well, so, you know, possible.
You know, and we mentioned social media and the role that it plays. And I think that if he were alive today and had a Twitter account, I think he'd be very, very busy because there's so many things that we know about right away. You know, I mean, just recently the story that's emerged in Flint and this water issue that is so outrageous that we don't even think would happen in this country. And yet here we are. Mm-hmm. And I can't think of a single person who doesn't have a stake in that in some way. I mean, that affects so many races of people, that affects men and women, that affects parenting, that affects real estate, that economic policy, political. There's just so many environmental. I mean, everything, everybody, every profession is touched by that story in some way. That's so interesting. And that was a story that popped up so quickly.
Sure did.
We were able to see it so fast and to see just how quickly things can turn. But I think that's also the good news, is that because we can see things so quickly, we can solve them much quicker, and we can rally around really important topics. Unbelievably, we are already out of time. I cannot believe it. I could really sit here with you guys for hours and just keep these conversations going. So you know what? We should do that.
That's right.
Everybody, go to Twitter. Max is at The Urbanologist, and Lee is at Lee Bay, B-E-Y, on Twitter, and we're all going to be there keeping these conversations going because they are about very important topics that we need to keep discussing and keep working towards meaningful change in this world and fighting for the things that we believe in and that matter in our world. So we're going to keep doing that on Twitter, and I hope that you'll join us. We're going to take a little break and then turn you over to our good friend Dave Hoekstra, who has a very big show lined up for you here in just a bit on 720 WGN.